Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
A look at what's happening across Connecticut. Melissa in the Morning's conversation with Governor Ned Lamont. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Wow, it was a busy session, but it's wrapped up and Governor Lamont is here this morning. Good morning, Governor Lamont. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa.
I'm so glad to have you here. First and foremost, before we dive into everything going on, will you please wish your wife a happy Mother's Day?
Annie, happy Mother's Day.
I just meant
absolutely.
For me. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I meant, will you please let her know that? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sound rude. Yeah, let her know we all wish her a happy Mother's Day from WICC and thank her for all that she does and your three beautiful kids. So happy Mother's Day to her. Just wanted to tell you that.
I know. Lucky Annie, she gets to spend Mother's Day with me at the Democratic Convention.
Well,
for better,
mean,
for worse, so death do his part. Uh-oh.
Is it till Sunday, though? I mean, it's tonight and tomorrow, obviously, but, like, do you have any
That's right.
time
yeah,
alone
no, we're,
Sunday?
We're done on Saturday.
Okay, good. So there you go. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Sunday, it'll be all about her. Okay, all about her. No worries. You're so funny. All right, so Governor Lamont, let's get into your biggest takeaways. What were the biggest things you felt were wins for the state of Connecticut, you were most proud of? Let's start with that.
I'm proud they got a very responsible budget done on time. I think that's incredibly important. You know, this is our first real post-COVID budget, and it took into account some of the long-term effects when it comes to, say, mental health and daycare, childcare, big investments in those two areas because they allow people to get back to work and help our kids get back on their feet. Also, it's the biggest tax cut in the history of the state. It's a more of a middle-class tax cut, but doing everything we can to make Connecticut just a bit more affordable in this inflationary time.
So let's talk about the tax cuts. I know the GOP was looking for more. And actually, earlier this morning, I know I had talked to Senator Duff earlier this week, and then this morning I had Senator Kelly on trying to get both sides of the perspective on this. Senator Kelly, interestingly, told me $1.2 billion that could have gone back to the taxpayers couldn't initially because of federal regulations. I don't know if that's true or not, but Senator Kelly said later on it was learned that that was not the case. So why didn't that money also why wasn't that given back to taxpayers?
Well, first of all, Senator Kelly is right. Under the federal ARPA rules, they wanted that money to go to more counselors in the school, more teachers, more corrections, all things related to COVID. They didn't want that to go to a tax cut. But we've had a pretty good organic growth here in the state of Connecticut. So that allowed us to do, a $600 million tax cut, most of which will be felt immediately this summer.
Okay, so yes, it's true that federal regulations blocked essentially the $1.2 billion just being given back to taxpayers. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, as we got more revenues came in, that did allow us to do more tax cuts. I think we're just about at the maximum. Maybe there was a little more space. But look, I think what you don't want to do is leave a big cliff in 2024, 2025. That's usually what they do in state government. They go from boom to bust. I want to make sure we have our rainy day fund. I want to make sure we can continue the programs we've got committed to right now.
And we're talking to Governor Lamont this morning, taking a lot of people's questions, as you can imagine, Governor. I'm going to try to get to as many as I can in the limited time we have. Thank you for taking the time. We have a question in regards to the teachers' pensions, wondering why we are, eliminating. It says, ask the governor about eliminating. Oh, why, I guess, haven't we eliminated taxes for teachers' pensions? Can you respond to that?
Well, the teachers have been promised a pension going back to the 30s and 40s. They don't even collect Social Security because the pension was considered their support at retirement. You know, we've shored up the teacher pension fund, so the unfunded liability is going down. It ought to give teachers some confidence that the money's going to be there as promised when they retire. I think those are the important points you got going forward.
And another question from someone who sounds like she's a nurse. Essential workers coming up short in the budget deal. If you're a business owner or an essential worker, she sent a clip here for me, and I'm kind of skimming through it quickly. But I think essentially what she's asking is why wasn't more money given back to frontline workers and businesses that, you know, if they use the Paycheck Protection Program, for example, that ran out very quickly, as we know. And I think they were hoping to see some relief. And if you were a frontline worker, I think they were hoping to see more hazard pay, you know, paid back to them from 2020. What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, for our state employees, we did just that. For those folks who were showing up every day, couldn't Zoom, couldn't go remote, you know, they getting some hazard pay and got a bonus going forward. Well, you know, for the broader population, you know, folks out of the private sector, I hope they follow Connecticut's lead. You know, we're taking care of our essential workers, and I hope they do as well. One of the things I did want to do was eliminate income tax for families earning up to about $60,000. That's one of the things we've done to make life a little more affordable.
When does that go into effect, Governor Lamont?
I think it goes into effect July 1.
Okay. So, all right. So, if I'm understanding it correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that's perfectly fine. But you would like to see the private sector basically do what was done for CBAC, what was done for the 40 or so thousand state workers, which is to look, give people raises, give them hazard pay. You'd like to see the private sector meet the standards of where the state is.
Well, I think they have to. We're in a very tight market right now. So if you want to keep labor, attract labor, have people able to wait on tables at your restaurant, you've got to be very competitive. You got to maybe pay a bonus and say thank you for being here for over the last year. That's how you keep great employees.
But how do they do that if they are still struggling to even make ends meet and pay for rent, for example?
Well, I mean, the most important thing we could do was get things open as fast as we could. So, you know, our restaurants have been open, at least for outdoor dining now, for, you know, almost all the time, and indoor as well. So now we got to make sure you get people there so they can keep waiting on tables. And because there's a lot of demand in our restaurants right now.
We're chatting this morning with Governor Lamont. And Governor Lamont, I know that there were thousands of applicants who would love to get one of those first few licenses, excuse me, to be able to open up a marijuana business here in Connecticut. A lot of people really upset about Connecticut Innovations investing over $1 million in a Colorado recreational marijuana company, bringing them to Connecticut. They are moving their cannabis pills company, their headquarters, here to Connecticut. And while, sure, it can make a lot of money, and Colorado certainly has over a decade of legalization, you know, they've got that experience. You can imagine local growers and people who want to expand their businesses and just get that opportunity, they're pretty upset about it. What was your response to them coming to Connecticut, and what would you say to those people who are still waiting to just get approval?
Well, two things. One, we do have many, many applicants to get approvals and the licensing for the retail and the cultivation of cannabis, like all of our neighboring states. This is the summer where it's going to get going. I don't know anything about Connecticut Innovations and attracting a cannabis-related company from Colorado, but I can tell you that they're always scouring the country and responding to requests of people who are inquiring about Connecticut. We've got a lot of folks looking at the state now in terms of moving their business or expanding their business.
So without knowing a lot about it then, Governor Lamont, it's probably hard to answer this, but do they basically, so this company, 1906, do they basically, cut the line? Since they've already been invested in, they're coming to Connecticut, they're already moving their headquarters here, do they cut the line and just get a license to sell here?
Let me look at that, Melissa. I mean, my hope is that they've got a strong local partner, hopefully maybe a minority partner or from one of the distressed communities. I think that's how you move ahead in the process.
Okay. That's the only thing I was confused about. I got a lot of questions about that. I've read articles on it. And other than telling me about the deal and why they reached out to them, I can't answer that. I have no idea. So I figured I'd throw it at you and go, here, you catch the ball and you tell me what I should say. I don't know. So, okay, cool. Thank you. I appreciate you looking into that. Talking this morning with Governor Lamont, he's taking our questions. And here's a question from especially the truck drivers. You know, we saw that we are extending the state gas tax. We're going to keep that away until December 1st. And and obviously the big question is, why hasn't diesel been included?
Yeah, fair question. I think two reasons. One, the gas tax cut, 25 cents right through December 1st, overwhelmingly, 95% go to Connecticut drivers. The diesel is often out-of-state truckers just driving through our state going forward. So a lot of that just goes to out-of-state, and that's not where our priority was.
Okay. So because it wouldn't, you didn't feel it was enough, that would be given back to the majority of Connecticut, it was left out.
I think that's right. And remember, we got to pay our bills. So, you know, when it comes to fixing our roads and bridges and speeding up our rail, we've got enough resources in the transportation fund to be able to take care of that. But I can't squander it all away, or else we won't be able to fix our roads and bridges.
No question. I think the only thing with the diesel that I would counter, if I may, is what about the fact that for truckers, now that they're paying so much more, we now have to spend more because we, the consumers, have to now pay an up price in groceries, for example, or whatever they are delivering. We are now seeing the upcharges as consumers because they've got to pay extra at the pump.
There's some truth to that, but it's also called the free market. I mean, we, the government, can't subsidize everything. There are too many, you know, back and forth in the markets. What we are doing is make it a little bit easier right now for people filling up at the pump. That's the most important thing I think we can do for the car drivers.
Governor Lamont is here. We're taking a few more questions before he continues on with his very busy day. We appreciate him taking the time to come on. Mental health seemed to be one of the biggest things tackled. Unanimous support in the chambers, which I thought was really telling. I think we all can agree that mental health has taken such a precedence. It was a problem before COVID, but COVID just exacerbated it. When do you think we'll start to see some of those things come into action? So, for example, like the part of the bill I loved, or that will soon be a law, what I loved was the idea of using as many resources, even from out of state, to bring mental health professionals into our state. How quickly will we see that happening, and where are these professionals going? Are they going just to schools, hospitals, places of business? Could you give us a little insight on that?
Sure. Well, first of all, we've already started, and I want to thank the legislature again, working on a bipartisan basis. We put together a bipartisan, you know, criminal justice bill. Mental health plays into that very strong there. Big increases. I love the mobile, you know, mental crisis centers.
I like that, too.
With a therapist. They get right to a location immediately. You don't always need a cop showing up these places, but you need the right person being able to be there.
Yeah, I was wondering, and I might have missed this because this was like a 166 or something page bill. I mean, this thing was a beast for good reason. But was DCF or any of it, because I remember there were talks, Governor Lamont, about DCF going on calls with police at some point if there was the money to pay them for mental health calls. Is that being included in any way or any kind of aspect of that, even if it's not DCF?
I gotta look. Let me call Vanessa Durantes on that. It's okay. A very good idea. DCF should be at the front lines. They have great relationships with parents and caregivers. So let me look into that.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I didn't read that anywhere, but like I said, I may have missed it. I'm sure I did. And then I have a very specific question for you, Governor Lamont. I am not familiar with this, but I had a woman call in. She said she was registering with the DMV new registration, and there were new fees that she had never seen before, like the greenhouse gas fees, I guess, and other ones tacked on there. And she's wondering why, and also if senior citizens could get a break.
Yeah, let me look into that. What I do know is we extended the renewal period so that you didn't have to, say, renew your license quite as often. And that was one way that, you know, you'd be able to save a little bit of money. I'll have to see if there are any new fees that have been added on there, though. I hope not.
Yeah, she mentioned like four on the phone. And of course, I didn't write quick enough before the next host was coming in. This was yesterday. And I just said a lot of fees. So I was like, I'll just write a bunch of fees. But I like I said, I haven't done a new registration. So I figured I would just check on that for her.
Yeah. Call Katie Dykes. Get her on your next show. She can answer those questions as well as incredible investments we've made in the environment.
Okay. Yeah, I certainly will. And actually, speaking of the DMV, really quick, Governor Lamont, and then I'll let you go. Do you know if they're making, I know we have to get the real ID done by May of next year through DMV. Do you know if DMV has made that possible through online yet? I know I think you still have to do it in person, but we've done so much now online with DMV. Do you know if that is possible, if there are capabilities to do real ID online?
Let me look into that in particular. We're moving everything we can online.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to that ID, maybe they need something higher.
Yeah, I don't know. I know all of a sudden, you know, AAA was like, hey, you need your real ID by next May. So I got an influx of calls saying, can we do it online? And I'm like, I don't know. Let me find out. So I just figured I'd ask you that, too. So I know I gave you a lot of homework as if you don't have a lot to do. But Governor Lamont, I really appreciate you coming on always. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right.
Take care, everybody. Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to your wife, too. Thank you so much.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Kelly. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well.
Are you tired? It's all done. It's over.
It's all done. It's over. But yes, I am tired.
I would think so. I would think so. And it felt like it was sort of a not as much of a race to the finish, per se, as like the last legislative session. I thought there were some really big things that, like, I can remember the whole midnight thing with the marijuana bill last session and everything. So this felt a little bit calmer, but I know that there were some things that did not pass. I know there were some things that the GOP, for example, wanted to see improved, like the criminal justice bill, the budget, for example, with more increased tax cuts. But how do you feel about this session overall? What are your biggest takeaways? What are the things that we missed the mark on, in your opinion?
Well, overall, I'm a bit disappointed and thoroughly underwhelmed. That's really what I think this legislative session represented, was one huge missed opportunity where Connecticut is actually in a position to do some really good things for the people of Connecticut. And instead, the majority, opted just to do the usual, you know, we have money, and so we're just going to spend it and not really make, I'm going to say, historic change. First and foremost, I think the biggest change was an opportunity to do some tax relief, and not just the temporary tax relief and tax relief that's going to be credits next year. Talk about reducing the income tax for the first time. You know, we had that opportunity. We could target the exact people who suffered the most during the pandemic, the people under, families under 175,000, individuals under 75,000, and go right there. We offered a $1.2 billion tax cut. It would have been the biggest tax cut in Connecticut's history. And the Democrats turned their nose up at it. And as a matter of fact, yesterday, when asked if they would, you know, have done more, they said no, because they thought we couldn't afford that going forward. But, Melissa, the fact is we had $4.8 billion worth of over-collected taxes from Connecticut taxpayers. That means we got too much money. We have a balanced budget. We have a full bank account. We are paying down on our state's credit card. And all we were saying is let's return some of that to the people of Connecticut. And the majority only wanted to do half. And the fact is they're saying that this is going to cost us. We can't afford it going forward. But then they turn around and spent $2.3 billion in spending. Doesn't make sense. If you can't spend 1.2, is going to cause out your deficits. Well, so is 2.3.
Right. It's a, you're talking out of two sides of your mouth. I am curious, Senator Kelly, what did you think about the fact that lawmakers are getting a bump in pay?
Well, you know, the majority in our caucus voted against that. We voted against the CBAC agreement, which was also state employees. I felt if I was going to say no to state employees because Connecticut taxpayers couldn't afford that, but they can't afford legislator salaries, too, I was going to remain consistent. And once again, I think if we have a state that's performing in the sense that it's dead last in job growth and dead last in personal income growth for in the nation for our citizens, that, you know, you don't reward the manager of the New York Yankees with a pay raise when you're finishing in last place. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, you know,
it's a good analogy. I mean,
it wasn't the right time to do it.
Okay, because the reason I asked that is exactly what you kind of alluded to, which is, you know, we have state workers who I know I've talked a lot about these CBAC plans from both sides of the aisle and with, you know, friends who are state workers. I'm very happy for them. You know, I certainly support the work that they do. I think what they do is unbelievable, and they absolutely deserve to have the money that they're getting. But I think the bigger thing that you were talking about and other GOP leaders was that, you know, then how do you compensate anyone who's not a state worker, essentially? How do you give more relief to everybody else and not just focusing on essentially a small group of people? And that was going to be my question was, you know, if we don't support the CBAC deal, like if you guys didn't support it, did you support the idea of lawmakers then getting a pay bump? Because that doesn't seem fair. But it sounds like you do not.
I did not. I voted against the legislative salaries for pretty much the same reason. I mean, the legislature in the state of Connecticut has, in large part, put Connecticut in last place in the economic categories that help Connecticut families. If we were number one in job growth and number one in income growth so that our families, you know, we got all the jobs back from the 2008 recession and our families and constituents were getting 10% increases in their salaries and wages year over year, I'd look at it a little bit differently. But when you're in last place, how do you reward that performance? You don't, in my opinion. I think obviously the majority thinks differently, but it's due in large part to a lot of their policies. And I think that's a big reason why Connecticut families struggle.
Mm. No, it was, look, I can see both sides in both situations for state workers, for lawmakers, you know, you get what you pay for. And I absolutely understand that. But I agree with you. I think there's still a big portion of Connecticut where if you have the money, it's hard to deny them. Why don't we give the relief when we can? You know, when we can, because God knows, who knows what's going to happen in the next year, 4 years, whatever it may be. And if our taxes have to be raised again, then it's like, if we had that money ready, why didn't we give it back to the taxpayers? That's the big question, it sounds like.
Yeah, I was disappointed with the failure to return $1.2 billion in tax relief. And our nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis indicated that we could do it. The governor and the majority were always saying that we couldn't do it under federal law, that federal law prohibited us from doing that. And we found out that, in fact, we had the money and we could do it and it would be allowable. And we just don't understand why you wouldn't give Connecticut families the relief that they're all asking for. I mean, we do have a 40-year high in inflation that's putting a pinch on the family budget. We know that. We hear that. And when we brought it up, the majority had no appetite and instead took that money and spent $2.3 billion when we already had a balanced budget. And that represents almost a 10% increase in spending. And that's not sustainable going forward.
Hmm. Really quick, Senator Kelly, before I let you go, did the next of kin notification bill pass?
I know it passed the Senate. We did pass that bill and got that through the Senate. I'm not sure how it worked with regards to the House.
Okay.
A lot of things happened on the last day where You see a lot of bills going between the House and the Senate.
Okay. I haven't seen anything on that. I just know that's something that hits really close to people here, obviously, from the two.
At home.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just wasn't. But I haven't seen anything. That, like Connecticut Post, nobody's written on it. So I didn't know if maybe you knew if it got anywhere.
Yeah, we just know. I saw it come across our desk. Obviously, I supported it from what I know about the issue in the greater Bridgeport area. And I supported that initiative.
Okay. Senator Kelly, we appreciate you coming on each and every week during the legislative session. And please don't be a stranger, even though this session is over. We'd love to have you back on the show whenever you're free and whenever we got great topics.
Absolutely. We won't be a stranger. Love the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. We appreciate
welcoming
all the work
to the show this morning, Dr. Cha. And Dr. Cha is a noted surgical oncologist with the Cancer Institute at St. V's, also a medical director of the Digestive Health Center in the Fairfield region. Dr. Cha, welcome. Good morning. Thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So this morning, we're going to be talking about colon cancer and how it can impact your liver. First of all, let's just address the fact that is this a cancer that immediately when you hear this diagnosis, it doesn't mean it is deadly, correct?
Absolutely not. Colon cancer is very curable, particularly when it's caught early in the polyp stage. You can even avoid the cancer, and that's why we recommend screening for anybody over the age of 45 now, which is a new recommendation, a lower age, starting about a year and a half ago.
So why did the recommendation change, Dr. Cha?
Well, for whatever reason, and we're not entirely sure, the average age of a patient who develops colon cancer is getting younger and younger. And this is really just in response to that to try to capture more of these patients with earlier stage cancer. It's a very common type of cancer. It's something that over 150,000 patients in the U.S. get per year. And part of what I wanted to talk about today is the fact that one in two, or almost half of all those cancer patients, will develop liver metastases or spread to the liver.
Okay, well, before I go into that, because I would love to understand, first of all, what that means, you know, you were talking about how it's very treatable and it can be curable. Of course, if you get screened ahead of time, it's probably much easier to attack it the sooner you find it. But it sounds like you've done a lot of these procedures to save lives with colon cancer. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. So the main stay therapy for patients with colon cancer, whether it's localized or spread, is to try to remove all the disease. We have very effective chemotherapy in patients with more advanced disease to keep the tumors at bay. But when we catch even early stage or even a little bit more advanced stage colon cancers, if we can remove all of that disease, patients can be cured. There's a variety of different techniques that we have. Whether it's laparoscopic or robotic removal of portions of the colon, as well as removal of wherever that tumor spreads. What is unlike a lot of other types of tumors and a lot of other types of cancers is if the tumor has spread outside the local area, patients are still eligible for potentially curative therapy if we can remove all the disease.
So is this a very invasive procedure, Dr. Cha?
Well, it really depends on what the state of the primary tumor and the metastasis, but typically it's something that patients can have done in a minimally invasive way using sort of the tiny keyhole incisions, and typically you remove a portion of the colon, put it back together, and the body is remarkable in that in 3, sometimes 4 days afterwards, it'll start to function again almost normally.
Wow. We're talking this morning to Dr. Charles Cha, and he is a noted surgical oncologist with the Cancer Institute at St. V's. So what is liver metastasis?
So it's a big word, which just means that the colon cancer, which starts from the lining of the inside of the colon, has gotten so advanced that it's now then spread through the blood system into the liver. So the liver is the main filter for all the bowels, and so it's the first place that cancers will spread to. It's sometimes referred to as stage 4 disease for colon cancer. What's different about colon cancer is stage 4 for colon cancer is still potentially curable, which is not true for other types of diseases.
Sure.
And so it's something that if we can come up with a plan where we can remove the disease in the liver, patients are still potentially curable.
So how hard is that, the difference between if you were to just do a colon cancer patient versus a colon cancer liver metastasis?
Well, for somebody like myself who does it day in, day out, it's something that can be relatively routine, but you do need to find somebody who is a specialist in liver surgery as well as colon cancer liver surgery. It's something that I oftentimes can do minimally invasively, but from the impact onto the patient, we just did a resection earlier this week where a patient went home after just one day in the hospital where we removed a spread to the liver. And so it's something that can be very well tolerated. And now that patient moves from a category where they are potentially uncurable to a category where they're curable.
Who's most at risk for this type of colon cancer impacting the liver, Dr. Cha?
Well, patients who have more advanced disease and patients who have already spread to the lymph nodes on the original resection of the colon cancer are a little bit higher risk. But really, it's quite common. I mean, almost half of all patients with colon cancer will develop metastasis to the liver at some point during the course of their disease. What is not well understood by both patients, and frankly, a lot of providers don't understand, is that even when it's spread to the liver, there's a lot of opportunity to remove these tumors. We don't necessarily use size or number of tumors as a barrier for us to be able to remove these tumors. I've removed up to 20 liver lesions in patients where we come up with strategies where we can sometimes remove one side of the liver, allow the liver to grow back, and then remove another lesion on the opposite side of the liver. So it really has to do with a remarkable improvement both in surgical technique, in chemotherapy, as well as the fact that the liver is an amazing organ and can regrow.
And I'm curious, because when you hear about colon cancer, to kind of bring it back to the beginning of this interview, Dr. Cha, immediately people think of recent Hollywood deaths like Chadwick Boseman, you know, only 43 years old, right, dealt with this kind of cancer for 4 years. And you hear about, okay, it can be reversible even at stage four. So it's hard to separate when you see these high profile deaths like a Chadwick Boseman in incredible shape, battling this for 4 years and ultimately losing it at the young age of 43. Does this just kind of speak to the idea of why we need to get diagnosed as early as possible? Or what do you say about those kinds of cases?
Absolutely. So being African-American does increase your risk for colon cancer. We're seeing things move at a younger and younger age, and 43 is earlier than we would expect to even start routine screening. And those kind of patients are the ones that are a little bit outside the box that are difficult to really diagnose. But if patients have any bleeding in their stools, they have persistent changes in their bowel movements, abdominal pain, unexplained weight loss, those are things that should increase your awareness for the possibility of colon cancer. A family history or any type of genetic history of mutations that increases your risk for colon cancer or other reasons why you may want to get screened earlier. So we say if you're at higher risk, you ought to get screened 10 years earlier than the first person in your family's age when they were first diagnosed. But it can be difficult in those patients who get colon cancer at such a young age.
Mm-hmm. So important to get that colonoscopy. And if you want to learn a little bit more about colon cancer and how it can impact the liver as well, check out hartfordhealthcare.org/cancer. Again, that's hartfordhealthcare.org/cancer. Dr. Charles Cha, we really appreciate you coming on this morning and for the work that you do professionally. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Dr. Cha here on WICC. If you don't work in the medical field, you may not know this. There has been a very long-standing need to improve registration process and specialty team activation for emergency situations. So the creation of an app called Triage, which reminds me of like Twitter and triage coming together. It's a pre-notification app that EMS can utilize to just expedite the process of registrations, activating key teams, like if you're a stroke team, trauma team. And it's this incredible app that's going to be launching next week. And we're so excited to talk about it ahead of time. So joining me this morning with all the juicy details is Terrence Sheehan, who is the EMS and Injury Prevention Coordinator at St. Fee's. Good morning, Terrence. Thank you so much for popping on the show. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I'm fine. So this officially launches May 11th, but how did you guys come up with Twiage? Where did this come from?
So they approached us, from what I understand, just offering their services. And, after we did a good thorough evaluation, we found that it's something that's going to, best suit our needs to go ahead and augment the existing technology that we have already and go ahead and improve the patient care to all our EMS agencies and all our citizens in our communities.
So how does it work?
So basically, an EMS agency, a transporting ambulance, has the application, on their iPad, whatever computer device they have in their ambulance, and they basically go ahead and type in few key points of information about the patient, what their condition is, what have you, and they can go ahead and transmit that information electronically, completely secure to the facility, giving us a heads up well before the ambulance even begins transporting the patient. So we can get a lot of information about the patient even before the EMS crew leaves the scene.
I mean, from your professional opinion, Terrence, tell us how much time is wasted, even though it's necessary, obviously, to have registration and things like that. How much time is wasted before something like Twiage comes into the picture and makes it a lot easier?
So I'm not sure that if there's a lot of time wasted, but it just expedites the care. So, for example, a patient could now go directly to a room when they arrive at the hospital rather than having to stop for a few minutes to, get registered, things like that. And further, that goes ahead and allows us to go ahead and, like we discussed before, activate the specialty teams much sooner. So they're actually waiting in the emergency department for the patient when the patient gets here.
So, okay, that's incredible. And again, we're talking this morning to Terrence. Terrence Sheehan is the EMS and Injury Prevention Coordinator at St. Vincent's Medical Center. And we're talking about Twiage, this app that's going to help a lot of teams out. And talk a little bit about that. This is free. It seems like it's very user-friendly. But which teams do you think will benefit the most from this?
So, yeah, absolutely. Super user-friendly. No cost to the EMS agencies whatsoever. So our the specialty teams in the hospital, our cardiology team, our trauma team, and also our stroke team are probably the biggest three that are going to benefit from that. All those conditions are kind of like what we call time-sensitive pathologies. So the sooner we can get the resources needed to the patient, the better off the patient is going to be.
Is this only going to St. V's EMS workers or all of Hartford HealthCare, which owns St. V's?
All of it's open to all EMS agencies throughout the Hartford HealthCare system.
Wow. So do we know if other hospitals are going to be integrating this or we just know for sure St. V's?
No. So all the hospitals within Hartford HealthCare are going to be going live with this all at the same time.
I see.
And then, yes, correct.
That's amazing. I mean, how do you feel about
yeah.
it?
I think it's great. I've been in EMS quite a long time, and I think it's something that's long overdue. I think any advances in technology that can go ahead and, improve patient care is definitely something that is necessary and definitely something I'm interested in. I think it's great.
And I'm just wondering if this is going to be something that granted, you're with Hartford HealthCare, but I'm wondering if other hospitals and other networks are going to pick up on this as well. Because, as you mentioned, Terrence, how long have you done the job that you're doing? How long have you been in this industry?
I've been at St. Vincent's for 6 years, and I've been a paramedic for over 20 years.
Okay. So, wow. First of all, thank you for what you do. 20 years. So there are probably many other people who fall under the same category as you. You guys watch this firsthand and you want to do everything you can to give life-saving mechanics and everything. And you want to save your patients to the best of your ability. I would imagine other networks would hear about this and want to get involved with this. I would think.
Yeah, I would think so too. I think, we'll, go ahead and get it out there. And I think once the EMS providers start talking about it and some of the other, systems see the benefit that it brings, I think they'd be very interested in it and look to see if they could bring it on.
So I understand it's free for you guys to use the program, but do you know how much Hartford HealthCare spent to get this all put together and be able to get it out there to everybody?
That I am not sure of, but like I said, there's no cost to the EMS agencies, which is huge. So, so any EMS agency that wants to get involved, they just have to reach out to us and we can work with them to go ahead and get them on board.
That is so exciting. Again, this is launching May 11th. It is a life-saving application simply that can be picked up on a phone, and it's going to help EMS workers across Hartford Healthcare, across the state of Connecticut. It's called Triage, and it's launching May 11th. And Terrence Sheehan, the EMS and Injury Prevention Coordinator at St. V's, we thank you so much for coming on and sharing all the details. Congratulations.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.